I call the meeting of the Higher Education Conference Committee to order. Today we'll be taking a deep dive into the state grant parameter adjustments made in the House and the Senate and in the governor's proposals. Like yesterday, this will be an opportunity for members to ask questions and for considering the differences between proposals, and we'll have members of the audience also take part in this as well. We'll begin with a high-level comparison of the state grant proposals from the governor, the House, and Senate. The spreadsheet in your packets show the parameter changes in each proposal, the cost savings associated with each, and the impact to the North Star Promise program. So, Ms. Birch, would you please walk us through the spreadsheet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, there are three spreadsheets included in your packets that I'll spend a few minutes orienting you to set the stage for the discussion of the state grant program. All three start with Higher Education Conference Committee comparison, impact of state grant parameter changes in the upper left-hand corner. And then they go on to say either state grant program, state grant awards, or North Star Promise program. Like Senator Fatte mentioned, these spreadsheets compare the governor's recommendations in columns A through C, House position without rationing in columns D through F, House position with rationing in columns G through I, and Senate position in columns J through L regarding state grant parameter changes, outlining how those changes impact state grant program spending, average state grant award amounts, and North Star Promise program spending. I'll start with the State Grant Program and North Star Promise Program spreadsheets. Those would be pages 1 and 3 of 3, since they follow identical formats. Lines 1 through 4 show available resources for each program. We have the base appropriations from the February forecast on line 2, the incremental change in appropriations included in each proposal on line 3, and the carry forward balance on line 4. For the 26-27 biennium, each proposal has different available resources for the state grant program, but the same available resources for the North Star Promise program at $105,804,000. Lines 6 through 23 show projected spending for each program. Line 7 is the projected spending based on the state grant parameters currently in statute. So for the 26-27 biennium, without making further changes to the parameters or applying rationing procedures, state grant program spending would be $689,198,000, and North Star Promise spending would be $72,682,000 per biennium. Starting on line 9, you can see how much the parameter changes included in each proposal are projected to decrease state grant spending and increase North Star Promise spending. The impacts of each individual parameter change contributing to the overall impacts are shown on lines 10 through 18. And we will kind of spend more time on those in more detail coming soon. The Office of Higher Education also modeled rationing for the governor's proposal for fiscal year 2026. And the House proposal requires rationing to balance the state grant program. And the rationing procedures and their associated impacts are shown on lines 20 through 23. On line 25 of each spreadsheet, the net balances are the total revenues minus total expenses after proposed appropriation increases, parameter changes, and rationing are taken into account. So at the end of the 26-27 biennium, the governor's recommendations leave the state grant program with a positive $29,836,000 balance and North Star Promise with a negative $27,347,000 balance. The House position without rationing leaves the state grant with a negative $60,758,000 and North Star Promise with positive $11,653,000. The House position with rationing leaves the state grant program with a positive $994,000 and North Star Promise with a negative $1,585,000. And the Senate position leaves the state grant program with a positive $3,623,000 and the North Star Promise with a positive $13,019,000. The Senate position also provides extended availability for the state grant appropriation and suspends surplus procedures through fiscal year 2029. So the Office of Higher Education would be able to carry forward that $3.6 million balance forward into the next biennium. And positive balances for North Star Promise remaining for any of the proposals would carry forward in the North Star Promise special revenue account. State grant appropriation changes, primary changes, and rationing also impact the size of student awards, which is summarized on that third spreadsheet, which is page 2 of 3. I just want to note up front that these amounts are in dollars rather than thousands of dollars, like most of the spreadsheets that come before you. So we are not awarding students $6 million in average awards. Line 1 shows the average state grant award amounts for each of the four proposals after appropriation increases, parameter changes, and rationing are taken into account. Line 2 is the projected average award amount based on the state grant parameters that are currently in statute. So without making further changes to the parameters or applying rationing procedures, the average state grant awards would total $7,823 between the 2 years of the 26-27 biennium. Starting on line 4, you can see how much each proposal is projected to decrease the average state grant award to come back to the totals on line 1. So for the 26-27 biennium, the governor's recommendations are projected to decrease the average award by $1,807, or 23%. The House position decreases it by $1,254, or 16% without rationing, and $1,800, or 23% with it. And the Senate position decreases it by $787, or 10%. Lines 5 through 15 break down the average award reductions further by dependency status and institution type, shown in terms of percentages. And I think that covers the walkthrough of the spreadsheets, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're going to get into the details later, but looking at line 17 of the impact of state grant parameter changes to state grant program spreadsheet, I'm a little confused as to why there are different numbers for the governor's and the Senate proposals. Could you explain that?
Ms. Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coulter, yes. So the way that different parameter changes included in each proposal interact with each other changes the total amounts. So that just means that, like, the specific combination of parameter changes included in the governor's proposal impacts the reductions associated with the change in application deadline as compared to the Senate position.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We'll now do a detailed walkthrough of each specific parameter change noted in today's agenda. For each item, I'll ask nonpartisan staff to describe the position of each, the House, the Senate, and the Governor. We will then go to the House co-chairs and the agency to speak about each proposal. And finally, we'll have representatives from the private colleges, the U of M, and Minn State to comment. So first up is the tuition and fee cap proposed by the House on R1, and I'll pass it off to Mr. Hopkins to describe that.
Mr. Chair and members, so this provision is a House-only provision that you can find on R1 of the side-by-side. It's on line 2.19 to 2.28 of the House bill. And this is in rider language for the state grant program. So this would only apply for the coming biennium. It wouldn't be a permanent change. And what this does is it creates a tuition and fee cap for all four-year programs under the state grant program. So regardless of whether they are private or public, all four-year programs are affected by this. And the cap is set essentially at the highest recognized tuition and fees for the program would be the current tuition for the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, So for the 24-25 academic year, and that would be allowed to increase by 1% in fiscal year 2026, and then 1% again in 2027.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hopkins, for that walkthrough. I think in the Senate we had some interest also in this. We had also some concerns that capping the tuition in the long term could cause a state grant to fall short of the true costs. But with that being said, we do know that it has also been driving the tuition growth has been driving the state grant program to increase also. But happy to have a discussion around that, and I can pass it off to either Chair Rarick or Chair Wagamot to speak to it.
Thank you. So, yeah, it was a concern, I believe, with both caucuses of the House that we kept seeing big increases in tuition, and particularly at the University of Minnesota. There's also a concern, obviously, of the tuition increases at the private colleges, but the biggest concern was at the University of Minnesota. And in particular, last year, it was a 4.5% increase, and they are also talking about a larger increase in tuition again this time. So it was something that was, although it doesn't net a lot, it's about a $17 million savings to the state grant program and the biennium. It was the hope that we at least have a conversation about tuition increases, and this was a really good way to get at that. So that's kind of where the House position is coming from, and we have great both partisan and nonpartisan staff, and this came actually, the idea came from one of our staff, so we always are listening.
Thank you so much, Chair Rarick. Chair Wagamot.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Per usual, my co-chair gave a very thorough explanation of this, and I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
Thank you. Would Commissioner Olson or Ms. Flores like to speak to the governor's position? Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you, Chair Pate. For the record, my name is Megan Flores, and I serve as the manager of state financial aid programs for the state of Minnesota. So for the governor's recommendation, similar to some of the other proposals, you'll see some similarities here, right, because there's only so many levers within the program to move around, and there's only so much money, but all three entities had different targets. So working with a $15 million above base target, what we looked at through the governor's recommendation is decreasing the LME allowance to 110% of the federal poverty guidelines, which does match a similar provision in the Senate state grant proposal, and saves the program about $35 million. Looking at changing the application deadline, similar, again, to the Senate proposal.
Ms. Flores, may I interrupt you? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to go through things item by item.
Oh,
but
I apologize.
We're just speaking
I thought you wanted
towards
me to go
this
over
piece.
All of them.
Yes.
So you would like me to speak specifically to which part?
The tuition and fee cap piece.
Okay. Yep. The governor's proposal does not have something related to the tuition and fee cap.
And I'll have Commissioner Olson also speak to it. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dennis Olson, serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and essentially ditto. I was coming up to say that very thing. This provision is not included in the governor's bill.
Are there any questions for members for either the Commissioner or Ms. Flores? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Would any representatives from the institutions like to share their perspective on this? Welcome. Please introduce yourselves for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I am the financial aid analyst for the Office of Undergraduate Education at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, my name is Nate Peterson. I serve as the Executive Director of Student Finance at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities.
Great. With regards to the tuition and fee cap, Mr. Chair, we understand the desire to control tuition increases at the University of Minnesota and at all colleges across the state. However, given the uncertain financial context we are in and the absence of other workable alternatives to reducing tuition and fees for all students, We do feel that the tuition and fee cap seems punitive, especially when it's limited to reductions in state grant for the 13,000 Minnesota state grant recipients at the University of Minnesota. Instead of rather addressing the full cost of education for those low-income students, we are essentially reducing the awards and passing that cost that is not covered under a tuition and fee cap to the students themselves without providing additional resources for those students. And so we do not like the tuition and fee cap. We would rather see other parameters used. In addition, we do want to just sense that it does almost send a message that low-income students should not enroll at the University of Minnesota, specifically the University of Minnesota Twin Cities in particular. And that seems sad, given that we have more than 12,000 Pell Grant recipients at our system as well.
Thank you.
Chair Fattah and members of the committee, my name is Paul Cirkvenek. I'm with the Minnesota Private College Council. I want to join in the remarks that our colleagues from the U of M made. All of them apply to private colleges as well. I want to tell you about tuition at private colleges. We set our tuition every year long before the state decides the amounts of state grants. And for the last 10 years, our net tuition has been flat. In 2013-14, the net tuition after all aid was $14,858. And in the 22-23 academic year, it was $14,690. Our institution's fastest growing part of their budget is their own institutional aid that they provide students. And they are doing things on the cost side to reduce costs to also hold down tuition for all students. So I want you to be aware that we are highly sensitive to tuition concerns. When you cap tuition for students, as Meredith explained, it deters a full range of choices for students. And for some students, an institution, a nonprofit institution is the best fit. If the grant program doesn't recognize a realistic amount of tuition, it deters that option for students who might be best served at one of our institutions. So we would hope you would not adopt this provision.
Thank you, Mr. Cirkvenek. Senator Putnam.
Mr. Cirkvenek, it sounded to me like you were talking about the sort of actual amount that a student pays after aid. How about the actual number of tuition? How much does that increase at the private colleges every year?
Mr. Cirkvenek.
I can tell you the percentage for our schools across the system. In this year, it is 3.8% across our 18 institutions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr.
Chair Fattah. Just to be clear for everybody, I think people understand this. That's the tuition price before aid is increasing 3.8%. That does not mean every student will see a 3.8% tuition increase. It will depend on their aid package.
Thank you, Mr. Cirkvenek. Are there any other members from the audience that would like to speak to this parameter? The Honorable John Bowen, welcome.
Every time. This Honorable Margaret.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Please
thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. I want to applaud the House for taking this action. For over a decade now, the legislature has put control of this variable in the hands of the University of Minnesota Board of Trustees. Well, I think that the University of Minnesota has a strong case to make for what its tuition is based on the type of education they provide. My concern is more around the private colleges and the fact that any increase to the University of Minnesota tuition is an automatic increase to students at private colleges. And if you compare missions, it's very clear that our private colleges are not R1s, and their missions are much more aligned with Minnesota State Universities. And we believe you could have even gone further to bring more fairness to this equation. But we do applaud the legislature getting involved in a variable in this equation that impacts only a small amount of students, only students at the more expensive institutions. and has driven a ton of money to those more expensive institutions and crowded out our own students. As an example, some background, in 2013, this tuition fee cap was $10,000. It was not set at a specific tuition level. It was set in statute at $10,000. Since then, it has increased by $6,882, going up to $1,730. At the same time, the Pell Grant has only increased $1,845. This variable by far has grown to a point where the legislature should step in and take action. So we applaud you doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grant, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Fate. I teach communication and I teach conflict management, and I tell my students all the time as we talk about what people fight about, they're not surprised to learn that finances and money are among the number one and number two things that married couples routinely fight about. And I tell them the single worst time to fight about money is when you're broke, and yet that tends to be when conversations about how we spend our resources tend to take front stage. So MSCF is also supportive of this cap, much like Jonathan's comments. We think we could have gone farther. I shared with the Senate earlier in session that I have had these conversations. And let me preface this by saying I think Minnesota is incredibly fortunate to have such a robust and diverse higher education landscape. And I desperately want to live in a world in which everybody gets to go to the institution that fits them best. But at our 26 colleges, our 47 campuses across the state, as open access institutions for 27 years, I've been teaching students who are at our doors in large part because, and I think we're getting better at it, but in large part have been told that college isn't necessarily for them, so they should probably start off at a technical school or a two-year. And so for many of our students, the assistance that they have to go to school is the difference between being able to go to college and not being able to go to college. I am currently the father of an 18-year-old who's shopping around colleges. We're incredibly fortunate. She's got options. And so all of our conversations are not whether or not it's going to happen, but what her options are. And within the last month, and again, I don't fault folks from the private colleges for putting their best foot forward by any stretch of the imagination, but we've had these conversations. I have been told, as I sit with my daughter, I know there's sticker shock, I know there is, but let me walk you through this. We have a presidential scholarship, so we're gonna take 28 grand right off the top. And then we're gonna make sure that you've got some skin in the game, so there's probably a little bit of loan here, and then we're gonna try to get you a job on campus. And then, if we can work in the state grant program, we can get our tuition in and around a state school. And at that point, I mean, why wouldn't you? And now I'm the first to admit, that sets me off a little bit. I get a little territorial for our four-year university brethren. The mere assumption that if you can get private college tuition in and around a state school, then the decision is an obvious one. I would argue it simply isn't. Having said all of that, I do think that a balanced approach is really the only fair way to approach this. When you look at all the levers for the entire time that I've been working in governmental relations on behalf of MSCF, I have seen students advocate for help, and I have seen legislators respond in kind by saying, you know what, we got to get the money to the students, and so we tend to increase the state grant program. If the state grant program gets more, by definition, the other players tend to get less. In response to getting less, they tend to raise tuition, and that is exactly the high aid, high tuition model that is really poorly serving many of our students. I think when you look at all the levers of the state grant program, it's almost impossible to address the need right now without addressing the key driver in this, and that is tuition costs. So I applaud the House for a creative approach. I think there are further steps we could take. I'd be happy to share those ideas with you if you have time. But other than that, I want to thank the House for their creativity, and I encourage you to include that provision.
Thank you so much. Our first question is from Senator Putnam.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. You know, as you were talking, it reminded me of a conversation I had with a former president of the College of St. Benedict's probably 10, 15 years ago. And we were talking about increasing tuition, and she really genuinely said this, that part of why they raise tuition is because when something's expensive, people think it's good. Openly said that about raising tuition at the College of St. Benedict. And as you were speaking, I started to think about the inverse to that, which is the assumption that when his college is affordable, people might think that it is weaker or lesser. And I think that dovetails in interesting ways with the argument you're making about fairness. So would either you want to expand on this notion of why this is a fairness concern specifically? You've mentioned it a little bit before, but I do think that there's more space to elaborate that argument if you're interested in doing so.
Mr. Bone.
Thank you, Senator Putnam, Mr. Chair. The tuition and fee cap, since Minnesota State University, universities are all well below the tuition and fee cap set in statute, any dollar above our highest tuition goes to students at more expensive institutions, whether it's University of Minnesota or private colleges. Our students are capped pretty low. So if you are deciding between St. Cloud State and St. Ben's, your award at St. Ben's would be almost double what it would be at St. Cloud State. We don't believe that's fair. We believe the missions of the institutions align pretty closely. We believe that although school choice is fantastic and it's still protected by any reduction to tuition fee cap, that our mission should be the important part, not the dollar amount that it costs to attend. So we believe at the universities especially that our students are heavily disadvantaged when comparing to what an award may be at a private college.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to follow up with the testifier on that. So my understanding is the tuition, the state grant program is capped at the rate of the Twin Cities University of Minnesota campus. So it doesn't escalate with a differential with the private colleges. It's whatever the Twin Cities campus rate is. Is that not correct?
Mr. Bone.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question. And that's true that they're tied to the University of Minnesota level. But because our institutions are well below that, our tuition and fee cap is essentially our tuition, the tuition at our universities. So a tuition at Winona State is around 9,000. That's the tuition and fee cap for a Winona State student. But the tuition and fee cap for a student attending the University of Minnesota or a private college is going to be the 17,370. So that's where you get the difference. And that's why this particular parameter heavily advantages students at more expensive institutions.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify for the record that it's married to the Twin Cities campus. It's not decoupled from that. Thank you.
Chair Rerick.
Thank you. So in the House, we had a lot of conversation. We had conversations about nonprofits. We had conversations around the University of Minnesota. I think they came in four separate days, and we had a pretty thorough conversation because we really wanted to know, especially in their beyond their O&M, what they were spending money on and trying to really understand. I think we spent days and hours trying to understand. And one of the things I got a data request returned to me. Basically, I think it was the last day that the University of Minnesota was here. And why it's pertinent to this is because I asked for the top 100 salaried people at the University of Minnesota. It was quite enlightening. Now, in fairness to them, some of them were, coaches, and I know that the athletics is all self-contained. I understand that. But the 100th person still made $354,000. And then that was from current. And then I actually had a transparency group that sent me their data request from 23. So it's a little old. But at that point, they asked for anyone that was paid more than the governor. And the governor at that time would have been $127,000. So this was anybody making more than $128,000 and up. And it was interesting to note that there were 2,169 people. So 2,169 people at that time in 23 making more than the governor. So there's, when we talk about tuition, all of these things are incredibly important to also talk about. So it kind of came in at the end of the hearing when we were there, but these are all things that we considered, and the House did consider a lot of different things, but we kind of landed on this to try to bring a fairness issue. And we did look at some graphs and some charts that were quite enlightening in the negotiations between the House Republicans and Democrats. And it was showing the gross tuition at the privates in particular, but also the U and the growth over the last decade. And that was rather enlightening. But I appreciate what you had to say. It was, there is a fair, in my view, there is a fairness issue, as you just stated. So I just want to kind of point that out, that that, at least for myself, I'll say, as a lawmaker, I'm continually being frustrated with tuition increases on the backs of students and families, particularly at the University of Minnesota. And so this is in response to that, because we have very little control over that. So this is one attempt and literally a pleading to them, please stop doing this. So now you've heard what I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Eric. Would you like to comment, or should I pass it to Senator Putnam?
It's an interesting moment between you guys. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to second Chair Eric's points and say that administrative bloat is a huge problem in higher education, a very expensive problem as well. But it's also a problem in the private colleges, where you have presidents making $900,000 a year. And one thing I think is fascinating about your list of 100 people at the University of Minnesota, the president of St. Cloud State is probably number 95 on that list. So it's different in the Minnesota state system than it is at the University of Minnesota, and I just want to take a moment to highlight that as well.
Thank you, Senator Putnam. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always like to preface comments like these to by saying that I feel like I sort of have one foot in all three different systems as a an alum of a private college and of the University of Minnesota, but also as the son of a longtime Minn State educator and former MSCF member as well. But I want to really just elevate one point that Mr. Bone made, because I, for me, you know, the sort of the exactitudes of this particular lever are not are less important than the concept of who is making the ultimate decision on the tuition level for the purpose of the state grant program. Because right now, that power essentially falls to the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota. And, you know, they're good folks. I voted for some of them. But as a legislator, it just doesn't really, frankly, sit right with me that that's ultimately where this power is right now. And so whether it's this lever or, you know, something else, I feel like we need to have a conversation about really the legislature and the governor and the folks who, the elected officials who are responsible for setting this budget, reclaiming that power and making that our decision rather than the decision of the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota. And so I think, to me, that is the real appeal to this particular measure in a very sort of general way. So just wanted to add that.
Thank you so much, Representative Coulter. Are there any other questions or comments or concerns from members? Oh, Mr. Grant.
Pardon, I just have one last comment. In light of enrollment growth, particularly at the two-year campuses, in large part because of the North Star Promise, putting higher education on the radar of others who probably would not have considered higher education, I do think it's fair to say that from an enrollment standpoint, all of these institutions working incredibly hard to vulture each other's students is probably not the way out of enrollment issues. I think the way out of enrollment issues is to broaden the entry, broaden the door, and invite students who otherwise would not see themselves there. Those are our students, I'll be completely honest with you. Those are the ones who disproportionately show up at two-year technical and community colleges. And I would simply argue that targeting resources at those students, the ones who also are existing with significant obstacles outside of the classroom, they may be completely on their own, they may be a parent themselves. I would simply argue that adjusting the levers that direct the funds at the students who could benefit from it the most is one of the reasons you see tuition or enrollment growth at our two-year campuses, and that's ultimately the way to continue it. It'll be the way to get them into higher education. It'll get them into their chosen educational and occupational field, and it'll ultimately address the workforce needs of Minnesota. So I just encourage that type of balanced approach, and in these times of limited resources, targeting the money at the students who could benefit it from the most, I think, is the most prudent approach. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Grant, and thank you, Mr. Bone. And that'll conclude that portion. We'll next go to the assigned family responsibility parameter changes. Again, Mr. Hopkins, would you like to walk us through the changes between the two or the different proposals?
Mr. Chair and members, so Mr. Watson will be discussing the two chambers' differing approaches to the negative student aid index, which is a big part of the differences between the two chambers regarding assigned family responsibility. But I will still speak to the assigned family responsibility, or AFR, generally. If you turn to page R48 of your side-by-side, this is section 7 of the House language. It's section 14 of the Senate language. So just for general context, the way state grant awards are calculated, you would start with the cost of attendance for the student, and you would deduct certain items, the assigned student responsibility and the assigned family responsibility. So this is something that's deducted from the cost of attendance when calculating state grant awards. So the higher an AFR is, the lower a state grant award will be. There are three main buckets of kinds of students. When you're talking about AFRs, there are dependent students, independent students without dependent, with dependents, and independent students without dependents. So the main difference between the two bodies about with regard to AFR generally, not including the differences regarding negative SAIs, is that on the Senate side, if you look to line 45.4, you see that for dependent students, the assigned family responsibility is increased from 79% of the parental contribution. That parental contribution is set at the federal level through the FAFSA process. So it's increased from 79% of the parental contribution to 100% of the parental contribution. So that would increase AFRs for dependent students and therefore decrease the amount of their state grant award.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. In the Senate position, it was important for us to maintain those differential rates for independent students. We saw that, we felt that in the governor's position, cutting setting the AFR to 100% would disproportionately impact both adult learners and student student parents. And so we set the AFR for dependent students to 100%. We preserved the 71% rate for independents with dependents and the 35% rate for independents without dependents. And so that's where we went. But I'd also like to pass it off to either Chair Rarick or Chair Wagenbach for the House position.
So I'll actually speak to your provision just really quickly.
Yes, please.
Okay. So one of the things, I have a chart that we use when we were doing negotiations, and I just want to verify that this number is correct. So I'm understanding that when you go from 79% down up to 100% for dependent students, that's a savings to the state grant program of 54.7 million. So that's how much less. So $54.7 million in the biennium would be what would be less going out to students that are considered dependent. Is that correct?
I believe it. I'll pass to Ms. Bursch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rarick, that might be the case in isolation or in combination with certain other parameter adjustments. But for the certain selection of parameter changes that are included in the Senate position, the reduction, the savings would be $52,423,000.
Chair Rarick, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you for that correction. Yeah, we have a chart, but it isn't, the numbers aren't always accurate as you put everything in together. So you said 52.4, I believe. Okay. So we chose not to do that lever. We did instead use a different lever, which I know Mr. Hopkins will talk about. So it was part of the reason, I'll just say the reasoning behind that we changed the student aid index back to zero as opposed to negative 1500 or just no cap at all, is because that was a fairly recent change and we were trying to look at anything that was within the last couple years of changes and kind of revert it back to the way the state grant program had been. So that is one of the reasons why we looked at that one. And that lever change does save the state grant or cost the families, like, depends on how you want to say it, $87.7 million on my chart. So that, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rick. And Representative Wolgamott, or Chair Wolgamott, I just want to be clear also, we're going to have the next section discussing the negative student aid index also, but I'll pass it to you.
Well, thank you. Nothing further to add, okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Commissioner Olson or Ms. Flores, would you like to come up to speak to the governor's position on the AFR? Welcome, Ms. Flores.
Thank you, Chair. So for the governor's proposal, again, we had $15 million to work with, the targets being different. So when we looked at the assigned family responsibility, we made the decision to allow the change to the federal needs analysis formula, which impacts the Pell Grant, to flow directly through to the state grant program so that the state grant program would treat that assigned family contribution in the same way or a similar way to what the federal Pell Grant does. And that allows that needs analysis to bring up that, because of the strain on resources, that assigned family contributions for all students to 100% and no longer modifying or offsetting the state needs analysis and allowing it to recognize that federal contribution. And again, because of the strain on the resources and the inability to have the resources meet the needs of the students through our previous offsets or modifications, that saves the program about $79 million per biennium.
Thank you, Ms. Flores. Are there any questions from members? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Would any representatives from institutions like to come share their perspectives? Or would any members from the audience like to come share their perspectives? Seeing none, we can move on to the next parameter change, which is the student aid index values. Which is also on R48. Mr. Watson, would you like to describe the proposals?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Mr. Hopkins was describing the interaction between the various student buckets and the federal needs analysis for parental or student contributions, there's the question, there's been a recent change in the federal needs analysis that can allow the parental or student contribution to go below zero, so to become negative. And so that would have the effect of an existing law, 100% of that is recognized in the AFR. So as that goes down, so does the AFR, which makes the grant award go up. In the governor's position, in the House position, that was set to, they allowed it to track 100% down to zero. So it sets anything negative, like I guess it just sets anything negative to zero. And in the Senate position, it's tracking it down to a floor of negative $1,500. So it sets that floor, which does reduce awards over what it would be in current law if it could go below $1,500. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Watson, how recent was that change to allow a negative SAI?
Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Eric, I'd actually like to defer to OHI on the exact timing of when that went to effect. I know it's pretty recent.
Ms. Flores, I believe the answer is FY24. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
No, FY25. This is the first year.
Oh, FY25. Thank you.
Okay, that's like it's happening right now.
Yes.
Okay, and it's at least on the chart I have, and again, this is probably an isolation, but it's an $87.7 million cost to the state grant program, which is incredibly significant, considering that about $211-212 million a year is granted. So it's incredibly significant, this change.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. And this actually was a position that was probably the most important item for the Senate. Yes, it's new, but at the same time, we felt strongly that the negative SEI takes into consideration our lowest income students, not only their inability to, or they're struggling to pay for college, but also having their basic needs met. And we were trying to avoid having or putting a burden on them in this. Yes, it'll save about $87 million, but we were able to match the house in the overall state grant parameter changes. So we felt that we can still make these changes without gutting that also. But I respect your position as well. And would like to see if anyone else would like to comment before we call up other members or other audience members. Yep. Welcome, Ms. Ferguson and Mr. Holling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm actually going to defer to Mr. Oh, I totally forgot your name for a second.
Chris.
Holling. Mr. Holling to introduce himself.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me appear here today. My name is Chris Holling. I am the System Director for Student Financial Aid for Minnesota State. First, let me say thank you. I greatly appreciate what you all do serving on this committee. We're very grateful for it. We have a great state grant program. You folks have what I would think is a kind of an unpleasant task here. It's certainly not fun. I'll be honest and say I don't envy you, but I really respect the effort, and I think the feelings you have for higher ed in Minnesota that lie behind the decisions you're going to have to make. The chair mentioned a second ago that in combination with other things within the Senate bill, that this particular item can remain in the bill because with other changes, they still accomplish the goals that they set out to do. What I would point out is that this negative 1,500, excuse me, that's clearly going to be applied to those students and families with the lowest income, the most financially needy families. That's how you get to where the floor is lowered in this case. The Minnesota two-year colleges have more students under $40,000 income than all the other systems in the state combined. So this will disproportionately affect those students. Those students are, I testified about this earlier in the session, that those students are much of the backbone of the state. And they are the students who really, really need the money from this program in order to get access to higher education. And access to higher education is something that is probably going to change their lives. And it's going to change the situation within the state. It's going to raise the quality of life. The state grant program is built on two pillars, access and choice. I'm here today representing the two-year colleges from the Minn State system, and that is the open access system within the state. That's the system that provides access. Now, just to be clear, I'm a Tommy. My wife is a Katie. My daughter's an Augie. I was the financial aid director at St. Thomas for 7 years. My father was a very proud engineering graduate of the University of Minnesota, and I was the financial aid director there for 7 years. So I do understand and appreciate choice. But I also am here to let you know my belief is without access, you don't have choice. If you're not able to get in, you can't choose. This particular change, I think, disproportionately impacts the ability of those students to have access. And when I look at the impact on one of the sheets that was handed out here, I can see that I think the Senate position overall preserves access and choice in a manner that's not as disproportionate as the governor's proposal and the House bill, where I see that the impact upon our two-year students was two or three times what it is upon the students at what I would call the choice institutions, the more expensive institutions and systems. I also noticed that the impact of the governor and the House bill upon independent students with children is also much higher than it is in the Senate bill. And we have a disproportionate, perhaps, group of those students as well. So I guess what I'm saying is this particular change, and I get that it is a recent federal change, but even though it's recent, it doesn't mean it's not good. It's not the right one. It's not fixing something that maybe needed to be fixed. But this particular change, I think, lies upon the backs of those students in our two-year colleges who can least afford and who the state can most benefit from providing those state grant.
Mr. Chair, the university concurs with Mr. Holling's statement. The negative SAI students aren't just poor. They are so poor they don't file income taxes. They are so poor they are probably the target of those hunger-free campus initiatives and actions. These are students who previously were unrecognized in the expected family contribution because the zero SAI is pretty much anyone under the poverty level. But we are talking truly the most needy students on our campuses. And so we feel that $1,500 that they did gain with the FAFSA simplification change was a boon for us. We actually had a way to help them that federal methodology allowed. And so we would hate to see that go away because we do feel it would harm those students who truly are trying to juggle housing, childcare, and food.
Thank you so much. Senator Putnam with the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holling, I'm really glad that you mentioned the potential disproportionate effects of certain changes on parenting students. Because I think oftentimes when we think about students who are in economic distress, we only see the dollar sign and we don't see the life that goes around it. In particular, you know, this in the Senate, I believe in the House as well, we've done a lot of work for foster parents, for fosters who are in college. And I'm wondering if some of these, if you have the capacity to talk a little bit more about the demographics or the lives of students who are at this kind of economic threshold, not just in terms of their income level or their poverty rate, but are we talking about more parenting students? Are we talking about more foster students? Is there more detail you can provide for us to get a better picture of who this would impact in the greatest?
Thank you. I will attempt to. I really can't speak to the increase in the foster situation. I would be reluctant to say something that I can't support. I need to delve into that. It's been pretty clear over the course of my career, which is longer than I want to admit, that we've moved from, I don't know, 90 to 95% of our student population being what we would call traditional recent high school graduates to, I don't know, a decade ago, we were looking at this issue in regard to grants for part-time students, and we were probably well over half independent. And of those independent students, many, many, many were parents, and many were single parents. Traditionally, in my opinion, the formulas as they've been put together don't really recognize the cost and the stress on those parents. In almost every case, the parent is working. And if they're taking care of a child or two or three and attempting to go to school at the same time, they're probably working full time. Therefore, they're not going to school full time. They're going to school part time. And Ms. Ferguson and I went around on this a decade ago, proposing some changes to the state grant program that would assist those students who were part-time. They were sort of, in my view, unfairly penalized by the state grant program formulas by being part-time. And we wanted to recognize the unfairness of that. And we were successful, at least for a brief time, in getting some changes made to the formula. And part of the argument at the time was it's not a matter of, let's pretend you're one of these students and you're a single parent and you have three kids. It's not that you don't want to finish quickly. It's not that you don't want to go full time. But as Ms. Fergus said, you're wrestling with housing and you're wrestling with food and you're wrestling with insurance and school and daycare. So it's life circumstances that are forcing that. It's not a choice by that student to behave in a certain way. They really almost have no choice. And so, yes, it's a very tough road, I think. Those are the kind of students that when I used to sit across from a student and try to advise them, I might get really frustrated because there's only so much that we can do within the rules, and boy, their lives are hard.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Are there any other questions from members? Thank you both for coming up. Senator Putnam asked a question about the FIG program, so can I call back up Ms. Flores? I'm sorry. Thank you. Welcome back, Ms. Flores.
Thank you. Can you repeat the question for me, Senator?
Yeah, so Senator Putnam had a question about FIG students in the past, so I just wanted to ask a couple of things. Number one, do fosters tend to have SAIs below zero?
So to answer the question, Senator Fateh, Senator Putnam, there are definitely FIG students receiving the Foster Independent Grant that have a negative student aid contribution. However, the Foster program does not recognize the negative student aid contribution in the awarding formula because that program is awarded a little bit different, where we're awarding up to the full cost of attendance for those students in that program.
Good. Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Did you also want me to speak to the governor's proposal related to this particular aspect?
Yes, please.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Fateh. So, as you know, this provision I would quantify it by saying we do also recognize the very important role that these additional state grant dollars have had on students whom likely did not have their basic needs met prior to becoming a college student. So these were unmet needs prior to becoming a college student, and becoming a college student very likely added additional stressors to their family situation. So definitely very supportive of the comments made by the other testifiers. In the governor's recommended changes for the state grant, we do have some language that allows the agency, it doesn't require it, but it allows the agency to set that minimum parent contribution or student contribution to zero when calculating state grant awards, unless the resources are projected to exceed spending, which is the current case if you look at the current provisions and this $240 million deficit we've been talking about. When we saw that federal change to the federal needs analysis, definitely there was an opportunity for us to rethink the state grant formula as we're learning more about this first year of implementation of FAFSA simplification. We have seen a significant shift in our neediest students, both in volume in terms of how many there are, in part due to the increase in students across the board, but we've also seen a significant increase in those who are measured as the neediest students. Under the expected family contribution formula, about 30-35% of our state grant population was measured as the neediest student with a zero EFC. Now under FAFSA simplification, we have about 45% of our state grant applicant pool who are measured as the neediest, who have a zero or less student aid index, with 40% of those having the full negative 1500. So 40% of our applicant pool now has that negative 1500 student aid index. So this change that we're proposing, allowing us, if we do not have the resources to fund the negative component, gives us that flexibility to align the state grant with the federal Pell Grant should we need to. I will note that the federal Pell Grant award does not provide a different award dollar amount if a student has a zero student aid index versus a negative 1500 student aid index. They award the same dollar in the Pell Grant award. So should OHE need to enact this provision because resources are projected to exceed spending, it would then align the state grant in the same way where a student with a zero SAI or a negative 15 SAI would get the same state grant award just as they do with the Pell Grant. I will note in some of the conversations we've had about the student contribution versus the parent contribution and the floor on that, Minnesota is the only state in the country that I'm aware of that is funding the negative SAI in a different way for their primary need-based state grant program. I think that's definitely something to be proud of, but it is also definitely something that has a cost. So since, you know, we're looking at trying to spend within available resources, like all the other levers within the program, it's something that we had to take into consideration in being good stewards of those dollars.
Thank you. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to that point, you know, if we had an $18 billion surplus again, that would have been the time to do something like this. But right now we're facing staring down a $6 billion deficit. And while it's lovely to do and awesome, it is draining the state grant program. So out of the $239 million, this is $88 million of that projected shortfall. It is tremendous. And again, as she just stated, that we're the only ones in the entire United States that are doing it this way. So I just want to point that out, that I would have loved to do this if we had an $18 billion surplus and continuing to have a surplus in the future, but we're facing a $6 billion deficit. And I don't think there's anyone at the table, as far as members go, that we're here when we are facing a $6.6 billion deficit. That would have been in the 11-12. So that was the November forecast was a $6.5 billion deficit. We had a much smaller general fund budget at that time. After the February forecast, it dropped down to $5.5 billion. So that is what we're facing. At least we have a little bit more revenue coming in totality, but this is, this would have been something to talk about when we had massive surpluses continuing, but they are not. They've been spent down to nothing, down to $6 billion deficit.
Thank you so much for your comments, Chair Rarick, and thank you, Ms. Flores. And I appreciate you saying that also, and I know you and Chair Wolgamott had to make tough decisions as well, and you both care very deeply about our institutions and our students, and I appreciate that. I just want to highlight again that in the Senate position, we were able to achieve the same cuts while also maintaining this. This was a very important program, and Ms. Flores speaking to the needs of the students, showing that, highlighting that 40% of the group between zero and minus 1500 are getting the full $1,500, and I think that's life-changing. Those are important for the students that need their basic needs met, our most neediest students, and it helps not only them pay for their basic needs, but also stay in school. It helps retention rates, and them staying in school also directly helps our students. But I'll pass it to Ms. Representative Robbins as well. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. This has been a very helpful discussion as someone who's relatively new to this. But I do wonder if you have any data. I know we've had a discussion earlier about the ghost students and people taking advantage of this program in particular for fraud. And this is a area of concern for me. So how are you, or is anyone else here available from OHE or something, to verify the eligibility to make sure that the people who are taking advantage of this are not ghost students?
Representative Roberts, I can speak to that. Yes. So the state grant programs, we definitely try to align with the federal grant programs when we can. They obviously have a little bit more resource as well as bandwidth when it comes to their technology. At the federal level, the federal student aid does have what is called an unusual enrollment flag. And so they are tracking. It is definitely something on our federal colleagues on their radar, where when they see repeat IP addresses, they see repeat addresses used in emails, they see an enrollment pattern where a student frequently changes their institution, they do mark a flag on that student's FAFSA, and the school is required to resolve that unusual enrollment just to do that second set of eyes to see, is there's something unusual about this student, the way they've enrolled, or something about them. And then they also do use that to target some of their fraud investigation. Since they're able to see students nationally and where they're showing up across the entire country, not in just in Minnesota, that's definitely a benefit for us here in Minnesota, having those federal resources focused on that. So we definitely rely on that, and our institutions are obviously concerned about this. Another additional protection we provide for the stakeholders in Minnesota is we're pretty strict in our scope of state resources. You have to go to an eligible Minnesota school to get Minnesota financial aid dollars. So our grant programs are non-transportable, meaning you can only use them at Minnesota. And through the Office of Higher Education, we do maintain, as well as Minnesota State and the U of M systems, those credentialings that are required through accreditation, as well as registering with the Office of Higher Education. And so I think that kind of trifecta of looking from several different angles, we also don't allow complete online entities who don't have a physical presence in the state of Minnesota to participate in our state financial aid programs. So I think just that piece alone, I think definitely when I talk to colleagues who work with financial aid programs in other states, those couple of differences that we've made as protections really do put us in a good place. We don't currently have data about that phenomenon specific to the state of Minnesota that I'm aware of, but we could definitely take a peek with our research colleagues and get some information to you if you'd like.
Ms. Robbins.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
It's fine. Thank you. I appreciate that. And so I would be curious if the number of FAFSA applications from Minnesota that have been flagged under the federal rubric, and then the percentage of those that are in the negative SII versus the ones above in the positive. I think tracking that, whether or not it's occurring right now, we need to just know, but then tracking it on an ongoing basis will be very important, I think. Thank you. Senator Fateh, Representative, I thought of one more item as I was jotting down that note. With the FAFSA simplification, if you recall prior to that, there was something on the federal level called the Future Act, and that was the making automatic the direct data exchange between the U.S. Department of Education and the Internal Revenue Service at the federal level, whereas before there was a data retrieval tool that a student could optionally use to pull their data from the IRS into their FAFSA. With the FAFSA simplification act combined with the Future Act, those two kind of coming together, it made that process automatic. So the only way a student can file a FAFSA, as well as a parent who's required to put parent information, is if they agree to accept that automatic connect. And so there are also some discrepancy flags that institutions will get. Whereas if a student says, I'm a non-filer, which is how one of the ways you can get that automatic negative 1500, if the Internal Revenue Service says, actually, we do have a tax file for you, it does have a flag so that those can be checked and go back and find out, you know, did the student maybe think of the wrong tax year? You know, it does get confusing with the prior year. Or was it the student who had non-filing, but the parent really did file? If the IRS has something on file and a student or parent says, I'm a non-filer, it will pick that up, and that has to be resolved before aid can disperse. So there are some efficiencies through that federal and through these federal laws that have definitely helped us pick up some of these potential discrepancies.
Thank you. Chair Eric.
Thank you. To that point, so now you've really got my curiosity going. Okay, so with this data sharing, if they're a non-filer, do they at least verify Social Security number or some other identifier so that it's a real person and not a ghost?
Ms. Flores.
Chair Fateh Chair Eric, they do actually do several database checks. So if the name, the Social Security, and the date of birth used, they're checking with the Social Security Administration. They're also checking tax records, and they're also checking citizenship. So while it is possible that someone has borrowed someone else's identity and filed a FAFSA, those checks are happening on that data. So if the data isn't in the database, they'll check that. But if the data is in the database and it's being used by someone else, they wouldn't have a way of knowing that. And that's kind of where that unusual enrollment flag will come into play. When we do look at these trends nationally, the students don't tend to stay in the same place long. The students who unfortunately perpetuate this crime, they tend to drop quickly, so that's another flag, who had a, you know, quick drop. And then they tend to move around a lot. So those are all things at the federal level that they're tracking at an aggregate level nationally. So not just for the state of Minnesota, but looking at that student enrolling across the entire country. And they can see that data. They also are checking, like I said, IP addresses. If there's, you know, 50, 60 FAFSAs filed from the same IP address, and it's not a high school FAFSA night or a correctional institution.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from members? Thank you, Ms. Flores. I believe Commissioner Olson, would you like to come up or? No? If you don't have to. You don't have to.
Here's your notes.
Oh. Welcome, Commissioner Olson. Senator Putnam has a line of questions for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Commissioner. I was told you wanted to comment on this discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't planning on it. However, this does, I think, continue the initial line of questioning from a couple of hearings ago around when we were discussing negative SAI, and you know, there was some testimony by Mr. Grant and others representing Minnesota State in particular about student refunds and kind of the prevalence and recent news around ghost students. I guess, I would just remind conferees here and chairs that this isn't a new issue. So, I think attempts to conflate, a recent change in the needs analysis, the negative SAI is not, what's triggering, kind of the phenomenon of ghost students and stolen identity. Just to have a student that, you know, would receive a financial aid refund be flagged as fraudulent is, you know, potentially inappropriate. So I would say that this is, these are two separate issues and not tied together, GO students and the new federal needs analysis. So no evidence that we're seeing of that particular link.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Commissioner Olson, and thank you, Ms. Flores. Are there any other members from the audience that would like to come speak to this? Mr. Dean, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you will begin.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of North Star Prosperity. And I just want to urge the conference committee to retain the ability to recognize negative SAIs in the state grant program. For student parents, this is not just a technical issue. It's really a lifeline. The decision to include negative SAIs directly affects families already facing severe financial strain. And I just want to kind of step us back because there's been a conversation about this being a recent change and just kind of remind folks that this has been part of a very long conversation at the federal level. You know, the recent change isn't just something that happened just this year, why it's being implemented this year. This was a 15-year conversation at the federal level, and it was actually a personal crusade of former Senator Lamar Alexander, who really sort of championed this idea of a better FAFSA. And the reason he brought that forward is because the process was broken. It was fundamentally broken. I remember very clearly one day during committee hearing, he stood forward and rolled out the 108 questionnaire, and it literally rolled down to the floor into the committee hearing. And I think that highlights how problematic the FAFSA has been for decades. And finally, the federal government did something and fixed it. And part of that fix was this change from the expected family contribution to SAI, because they knew it wasn't adequately evaluating a student's sort of contribution to their own higher education. For many of these students, particularly low-income students, the reason it is a negative SAI is because when that student goes to college, that actually has a negative economic impact for that family during that period of time when they're in college. Because for many of these low-income students, they're contributing to their family economic situation by working and helping to pay for rent and bills. This committee heard from Karina Valeda earlier on. She fits exactly that scenario where she is currently a parent, a single parent, living with her parents and sharing in the cost of rent, the mortgage of the house, food for the family. And so when you take that student's income away, that has a negative impact on the overall family. And that's why we have negative SAI. So I think it's really important for us to recognize that this really reflects extreme economic hardship for these students. Conditions far worse that's represented by that just zero SAI. And student parents often have these higher living expenses. And if we don't take the take that into effect, like childcare, diapers, transportation, housing. These are real costs that make it significantly harder for these students to go to school. And if we ignore them, then we're effectively erasing these burdens from the aid calculations and leaves these students without the adequate support. And so that's why the federal government made these changes, and that's why it's important for Minnesota to continue to recognize them. And why Minnesota is the only state that's doing this right now, in conversations I've had with folks at the national level, they actually see Minnesota as a model. And we'll probably see in the next few years many more states replicating what Minnesota is doing, because we're doing what everyone wants to do, which is make sure that this aid is going to the students that need it the most. And just right now with the state grant shortfall, it really requires you to strategically use these limited resources. And I can't think of a better place to make sure that those dollars are being used wisely than these particular students. And so we really urge you to prioritize those who face the greatest barriers to completion, and it's these low-income students that have the negative SAI. And so if we really care about workforce development, degree completion, it's this place where you can make the biggest impact on your investment in really supporting these type of students. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Are there any questions for Mr. Dean? Thank you. Mr. Bowen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Grant.
Jonathan Bowen, IFO. I'm going to look at page 2 of 3 of the Senate fiscal analysis, and just compelled to come up after hearing the amazing testimony of Mr. Holling and Ms. Fergus, and to have Minn State and University of Minnesota financial experts sit up here and explain the importance of this one provision, I think is strong. And in continuing the line of of comments around fairness. I want to start at line 8, Minnesota State two-year colleges. And you can see the dramatic difference between the reduction in the expected awards between the governor's plan, the House plan, and the Senate's plan. And if you go down one more line, number 9, Minn State Universities, the governor's plan, 41% reduction, 30% reduction. And you go across the House and the Senate, I think a large, the main reason that the numbers on the Senate side are so much smaller and all grouped closer together is because of this change that they're making, because they are protecting those students at the community colleges and in some of our universities, those that really need the aid the most. So I just think that's a really enlightening page that clearly identifies what Mr. Holling was referencing in his testimony more generally.
Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Mr. Grant.
Thank you. Mark Grant, Minnesota State College faculty and IFO's emotional support faculty member. I only came up here just because I want to reiterate as well Mr. Holling's testimony. In the 27 years I've been at DCTC, the single largest shift has been the focus on basic needs, unequivocally, outside of course, all of the curriculum and tech changes in technical courses and all of that. The focus on the students has been basic needs. And when students are struggling, when citizens are struggling, and they're struggling to make ends meet, and they're struggling to have some social mobility, we tell them to go to school. And this is the way that those very students are able to enter our classrooms, our labs, our shops, is this level of support. So MSCF strongly encourages the Senate position on this. Thank you.
Thank you so much, both Mr. Grant and Mr. Bone. If there's no further questions, we can go to the next portion, which is the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. Mr. Hopkins, would you like to walk us through the differences between the bills?
So, Mr. Chair and members, this provision is on R50 of the side-by-side. This is a Senate-only provision beginning on page 47. Line 14 of the Senate language, it's Senate Section 16. This was a governor's provision. So this affects the cost of attendance for purposes of the state grant program. The state grant program has its own particular calculation for an institution's cost of attendance. That calculation consists of an allowance for tuition and fees and an allowance for living and miscellaneous expenses. So the change in that's in the Senate language here, you can see it at 47.19. It changes the default living and miscellaneous expense allowance for the state grant program from 115% to 110% of the federal poverty guidelines for a one-person household in Minnesota for 9 months. So because that has the effect of lowering the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, it lowers the cost of attendance for the state grant program, which has the effect of reducing state grant awards. Just for some context, so the default living and miscellaneous expense allowance was added by the legislature in 2015. The legislature still has the power to set in law a specific living and miscellaneous expense allowance, but it has relied on this default since 2015 when it was added. And when it was added at 100, at essentially 100% of this same calculation, and that number has gradually increased since 2015 to its current 115%. And again, the Senate provision here reduces it from 115 to 110.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hopkins. And in the Senate, we had to make some difficult choices. We were proud last biennium that we're able to increase the LME from 109% to 115%, but given our situation, we reduced it down to 110%, which, although tough, is still a point above where we were at last biennium. So that's where we made the decision. I can pass it to either chair to speak on the House position, if you would like.
Yeah. I'm gonna pass it to him.
Okay.
I guess in all transparency, this was something that came up in our negotiations, and again, we all talk about the tough choices that had to be made, our zero target. Our caucus was pushing for what wound up being the Senate position, but this is something that Chair Rarick felt really strongly about, and she was successful in getting that in through the negotiations.
Chair Rarick.
Yes. So this is something that I was very willing to look at, and mostly because it is a small amount spread across every single grant recipient. The numbers I had in front of me was if we went to 110, which is what yours does, it's a loss, or it's $176 per year less is the number that I was given. And that's the governor's position as well. And the one good thing about this is that it does spread the pain, I guess, over all of the grant recipients. So it's fair in that way. We had a zero target, and so we had really difficult decisions. You had 100 million, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in these realms, in these talks, it's a lot. In these days, it's a lot. So it was, we were looking at doing cuts and reappropriations, and so this is kind of where we had a really difficult negotiation, as you can imagine. So this is one of the things that we got stuck at, and so that's why we have $62 million still kind of a hole in the grant program. That's kind of where we got stuck. So here we are. We're going to work with you now.
Thank you. Awesome. And to reiterate what Chair Rick said, on the Senate, we did have $100 million in the first biennium and $25 million in the tails. And the House did not have that. They had zero. So they had to make a lot more difficult decisions. So thank you, Chair Rick. Would anyone from OHE like to come up and speak to this LME parameters? Welcome back, Ms. Flores.
Thank you, Chair Pate, members. So the Office of Higher Education, again, we had $15 million coming in plus the current budget. So again, we also were faced with difficult decisions when trying to look at which policy levers, and ended up with the same conclusion that the Senate did in kind of looking to adjust that LME across all students across the entire state, regardless of two-year, four-year, or sector, and recommending changing it from 115% down to 110%.
Thank you so much, Ms. Flores. Any questions? Thank you so much. Any other representatives from other institutions would like to come up to speak to this? Or any members from the audience? Seeing none, we can move on. Yep. Next, we'll go through some of the language around the rationing for the next parameter. Mr. Watson, would you like to describe the language?
Thank you, Chair Fate, members of the committee. So this is a Senate-only change to the portion of the state grant program that sets out how awards should be reduced when there's an insufficient appropriation. We sometimes call that rationing. There's not, the Senate adds language, and we're on R51, and it's section 17. The Senate adds a paragraph B there that just sets out three sort of instructions on how the rationing parameters are to be applied. The first says that the assigned family responsibility, so that I'll just, describe the two ways that awards are reduced under current law. The first is to add a surcharge to the applicant's assigned family responsibility. So going back to the AFR calculation, where the AFR is assigned a percentage of the federal needs analysis, either parental or the student contribution. So say it's at 79% for a dependent student, adding a surcharge would bring that up to 80%. And so that would increase the AFR and thus reduce the award. And then the second way that awards are reduced is to do a percentage increase to the assigned student responsibility, which is when Mr. Hopkins was describing how the state grants are calculated, and you take the cost of attendance and you subtract AFR, you also subtract a student responsibility, which is set in statute at, 51%, 50%, sorry. of the cost. So that's just another thing that's going to be subtracted out. So you increase that assigned student responsibility to 51%, and that again is going to reduce the award. The added Senate language adds a few directions on how this is to be applied. The first is to say when adding the surcharge to the assigned family responsibility that the percentage of the federal needs analysis may exceed 100%. So with the Senate changing for dependent students that percentage to 100%, this would just ensure that as OHE is reducing the awards with the surcharge, they would bump up each bucket of student at the same with the same surcharge. And so instead of stopping at 100%, it would be 101% of the federal needs analysis, or 102 as it goes up. The second direction is that when adjusting the surcharge, the same surcharge has to be applied. This is similar to the change right before. The same surcharge has to be applied across every category of student, dependent or independent, independent with dependents. And then the third instruction directs that OHE may not use any other method than those provided in this subdivision to reduce awards. So this is the only means of rationing available to OHE when calculating state grants with insufficient appropriations.
Thank you so much, Mr. Watson, for that walkthrough. And the Senate position just reinforces the rationing procedure that is in statute. But I can also pass it to either Chair Rarick or Chair Welcome up for the House position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, we didn't include specific rationing. We just left statute as is. So, and I think, I mean, doesn't the net effect of this change do the same, or is this different than existing statute and existing rationing procedures that they already have?
Mr. Watson?
Thank you, Chair Fateh. My understanding that this reflects current practice, but I would defer to OHE on that. It's just in codifying it in statute.
Thank you.
Would anyone from OHE like to come? Ms. Flores. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Fateh. Actually, this is different language. One part that I would point out is it could be interpreted differently, or the law is a little bit silent on if, prior to this proposed change, on if the surcharge could go above 100%. And so this would be a little bit more prescriptive in saying that it definitely could. So that's one thing to note. I think the other piece is, if I'm recalling correctly, in the past it was that the two changes had to be in relatively equal dollar amounts, and I believe this one is using an and, where it's saying that they, and also clarifying or making it more prescriptive that the bump has to be the same surcharge percent to everyone, whereas before it was an overall dollar amount impact being the same.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when Mr. Watson was describing that, that is the same thing I had a concern about, because those three buckets are not equal, how they interplay with Pell. And there's a reason why when you know, what would seem logical in the spreadsheet where you've got a student that has children, they actually get less state grant because they get more Pell. And so I was concerned about that too, that was the language. So thank you for pointing that out again. As Mr. Watson was describing that, that kind of stuck out to me as well. Thank you.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have more broad comments related to flexibility. I guess first and foremost, I appreciate the flexibility that's retained in both bills. Overall, just reflecting back on my testimony during our very first conference committee hearing, I kind of pleaded and requested for, a balanced approach, particularly within the state grant here, especially given the uncertain federal environment and what we're potentially seeing with proposed changes to the Pell Grant. this is, you know, to Ms. Flores's comments, a little prescriptive. You know, so I would appreciate the ability to retain some additional flexibility, particularly when the legislature is not in session and we don't have the ability to come back to you if we do have to make adjustments midstream. So that would be my comment on behalf of the agency, is just to retain as much flexibility as we can.
Chair Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I could not agree more. We didn't touch any of the rationing parameters that you currently have. And who knows what the future will hold. Maybe we'll have an explosion again of enrollments, and maybe we'll have a huge dip. We don't know, but we're not always here. So I appreciate that comment. I have the same concern, and I would like to at least, I'll just speak for myself, and I think that my member to my right would also agree that the House Republican would like to see, we would like to see you have more flexibility, not less. And I am really concerned about it being a percentage difference as opposed to a dollar amount, because those two are not equal. They're very different in those three buckets and how they interplay with each other. So I'll turn it over, though, to my other co-chair, because maybe they have a different opinion. But I'm with you 100%, Mr. Commissioner. Commissioner Olson.
Chair Wolgamott.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. Yeah, we agree with the governor's position on this.
Thank you so much. Are there any other questions from members for either Ms. Flores or the commissioner? Seeing none, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Ms. Fergus, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do want to just clarify a few things about the rationing language. This language was solicited from the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State following our Senate hearing earlier this year. And it really was initiated because the Office of Higher Education indicated that the current statute lacked clarity. And so rationing has been implemented three times since 2000. Rationing was required in 2003 when the state grant ran a deficit, in 2010 and 11 when the state grant, when the entire nation was in a recession, and again this year. So the difference is that in 2003, OHE did not cut state grant awards. Instead, they transferred the entire appropriation from child care and work study over to the state grant program to resolve the deficit. Now, that didn't quite go over so well. So in 2009, 10, and 11, we actually, the Office of Higher Education, and I was one of the staff in charge of rationing at that time, met with the chairs, Chair Pappas and I believe Chair Rocavina at the time, and walked through the language with them and their staff to make sure we were implementing it correctly. At that time, the rationing language was interpreted to mean that this AFR surcharge was a percentage point increase. So if you had a current AFR of 0.9 for dependent students and you applied a 15 percentage point increase, it would go to 105. If for independent students without children it was 0.5, it went to 0.65. So we tried to maintain that equity that Chair Rarick mentioned that she wanted. So it wasn't necessarily a percentage increase in the sense that it was inequitable, but to make sure that the increases, that the reductions in award made by the AFR rationing language specifically were made across all groups, but were proportional to income and assets, but in conjunction with the current AFR set by the legislature. So the goal was try to preserve those legislative instructions as much as possible. The rationing language overall is meant to only take two actions, and really those are meant to be equitable across students. So the first is an increase to the assigned student responsibility. What that means is all students are reduced across all income levels, but the reductions are made proportional to cost. So the University of Minnesota and the privates take a larger reduction under an ASR increase, and the Minnesota two-year colleges take the smallest reduction under an ASR increase. The second change is that AFR change, and that is to protect students who had a zero EFC or now a zero or negative SAI. So they take no reduction in step two, but instead the second reduction to the AFR is made proportional to income and assets, so that a student from a family with a low SAI has a smaller reduction than a student from a family with a high SAI. So the goal was to try to protect the lowest income students, make the changes in a fair and equitable manner. That said, the rationing procedure that OIG implemented this year did not follow that kind of actions that were taken in 2010 and 2011. Instead, OIG increased the AFRs to 100 for all groups, They also did ration the ASR, but because those two steps did not ration adequately because of that cap, not allowing the AFR to go above 100, OIG also took the steps to change the application deadline, which really negatively impacted low-income students who applied late or who applied for who would have started in spring term, and to defund summer term. Those two actions were outside the original intent that we perceived in 2010 and 11, which is why we felt the language would be good to clarify. That said, you have the choice to disagree with the language we gave you. You can clarify it as you see fit, but that is kind of what the impetus of the language was. And it really was for institutions as well as OHE to get on the same page with the legislature about what should be done when rationing is needed.
Thank you so much. That was helpful. Are there any other questions from members? Seeing none, thank you so much. Are there any other members from the audience that would like to speak to this as well?
Does anybody understand it?
Does everyone understand is the question.
This is deep in the weeds.
Very much so. Awesome. And so we can go to the next portion then, I guess. We can go to R51, the surplus appropriation. Mr. Watson, can you tell us about the language, please?
Thank you, Chair Fateh. The next section are Senate changes to the section of the state grant program that gives direction on how to handle a surplus appropriation. So when there is more money appropriated from the legislature to the state grant program than there is need. In current law, and I should say that the way that this works is it is done in the second year of the biennium. There'll be money that would, I think, otherwise cancel back. So in current law, the way that awards are increased is by increasing the living and miscellaneous expense allowance in the second year of the biennium up to any amount that retains sufficient appropriations to fund the projected grant demand. And I think the Senate has added a second available increase, which is going back to the assigned family responsibility. The Senate language sets that floor of negative $1,500 when recognizing a negative parental or student contribution. This would allow OAG to go below that $1,500, which would have the effect of increasing awards for those students that have that recognized negative need. The Senate also adds language in paragraph B directing OHE to make the negative SAI adjustment before increasing the living and miscellaneous expenses across the board. So those are sort of two independent but related changes to the surplus procedure.
Thank you so much for the walkthrough. And on the Senate side, our intent was giving OHE the ability to both recognize the negative SAI and the LME, but with some feedback and discussions, it probably no longer does what it's intended. But I can also pass it off to the House for your positions as well. Chair, go to Representative Robbins first, and then
Chair Waldman.
Thank you. I just had a question for Mr. Watson. I may have misunderstood you. Where does it say that they have to do the assigned family responsibility first? Could you point that out to me again?
Mr. Watson.
Sure. So this is on R51, Section 18, Paragraph A on the Senate side. Well, sorry. So if you look at Paragraph B, the second sentence says, each time the commissioner makes an adjustment under the subdivision, the commissioner must use any surplus to fully reassess assigned family responsibility under paragraph A, clause 2, before increasing the living and miscellaneous expense and allowance under paragraph A, clause 1.
Thank you so much. Chair Walgamott.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm really hoping that over across the hallway, they are planning on giving us such a big target that we have to address this procedure in the very near future. I'm guessing that's what's going to happen. In the event that doesn't happen, you know, to be honest, from at least from where I'm at, it's given that we really spent all our time looking at how to address the deficit. This isn't really something we've explored. You know, I would certainly be open to your position feels like we've got other, we kind of focus on some other things in our conversations.
Awesome. Thank you. Yes. Good. Awesome. Would anyone from OHE like to come speak to the governor's position on the surplus appropriation, or we're good? Awesome.
We're wearing them out, you
know. We are. I'd like to call up Commissioner Olson. No. next up, we got R52, the lifetime credit eligibility. All three proposals lower the cap from. Oh, okay. Well, the House and Senate position lowers the cap from 180 credits to 120 credits. So we both are aligned on that. Would anyone like to speak to that, or should we move on?
Yes.
Yes. Would you like to go test? Mr. Oman, please come up. Sounds good. We'll move on to the final piece, R52, the application deadline. The Senate adopted the governor's request to move the state grant deadline up to the 30th day of the academic term. While the cost savings is relatively small, my understanding is that this will allow OHE to project total program costs earlier and prevent last-minute rationing from happening. But we also recognize that this could exclude some group of students who tend to apply for aid later as well. And I believe also Representative Coulter brought that concern to us as well. So I'm willing to listen to our perspectives from our House colleagues as well. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've raised some concerns about this. I mean, as you said, the dollar figure savings itself is relatively minimal. And I won't use, since we're in polite company, I won't use the word that I used with Commissioner Olson when I asked him about this. But my concern really isn't so much the dollar figure as just the way we're going about it, that we are, we're sort of pulling the rug out from under students by and then just sort of baking into the system that because they're not submitting a certain form at a, you know, at 30 days after the term begins, that they're leaving money on the table that they are otherwise qualified for. And that's just one of those sort of systemic things that I just have a real problem with. And so I have some real concerns about that. And I think when we, in particular, when we think about the students that that's most likely to affect, I think those are the students that we would probably, I would venture to guess are the students who would need the most help. So I don't know if our friends from Minn State or the U of M have any thoughts on how that might affect their institutions in particular. But that's just a concern that I wanted to raise on that particular proposal.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Is anyone from the audience in general would like to come speak? Welcome, Mr. Halling. You may proceed.
Thank you again. My name is Chris Halling. I'm the Minnesota State System Director for Student Financial Aid. And I would just say very quickly, I guess, that in a perfect world, I think, yes, it would be ideal not to have a deadline. But if there's going to be a deadline, I think our position is that this is fairly reasonable. We certainly would not want to see something right at the beginning of the term, and it's for the reasons that you enumerated. We tend to have students at our colleges who are making decisions, many of them making decisions relatively late. For example, for the fall, they might be making decisions late in the summer. My son, who had a health issue, found himself in recovery about the middle of August, a year and a half ago, and he really, really wanted to go back to school because he wanted to change his life. The fact that he could apply right up to and even after the beginning of classes was really important for him because he was able to keep momentum and take advantage of that. So having at least those 30 days to finish the application and apply for financial aid is important. So if there's a deadline, this I think is a reasonable one.
Thank you so much for that. Are there any questions for our testifier? Seeing none, thank you so much. Are there any other members from the audience that would like to come speak to this, or Representative Coulter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just sorry to excuse me, sorry to double dip here, but I two other just quick points on this is I think there probably is an advantage to having the application deadline as a consistent date in the year rather than relative to the beginning of the term. And my other concern with this is that this was also, I believe, a change we just made 2 years ago in our state budget. And my worry is that if we start going back and forth on this, that inconsistency will, I think, make students feel like they're kind of being jerked around. And so my hope is that this is an aspect, again, because the dollar figure is relatively small, that where that sort of consistency, I think, would be really, really important. So just wanted to add that as well.
Thank you so much, Representative Coulter. Assistant Commissioner Robinson or Ms. Flores, would you either like to speak? Welcome.
Hello, thank you. For the record, my name is Wendy Robinson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants at the Office of Higher Education. And I just wanted to add an additional piece of context to the idea of having an application deadline, and that while this wasn't sort of the driver behind this decision, I actually think that there's an important student success component to this conversation as well. We know that when students are kind of late arrivers into their higher education system, if they apply late, if they are late with their financial aid application, they typically face a number of barriers that impact their ability to be successful, especially in that first semester. I mean, if they've started the semester and they don't have financial aid in place, they likely may not have funds available to buy books and supplies that are necessary. Oftentimes they, you know, they just may have a variety of life challenges, and the late financial aid application is just kind of one piece of a often complicated life puzzle for those students. Long term, it is in the best interest of students to get their financial aid applications in as soon as possible and as early. Obviously, the ideal is to get it in prior to the semester beginning so that when they start the semester, they know exactly how much money they're getting, they know exactly what their financial resources are going to be. And so long term, if this is something that maybe will help incentivize some students to get those applications in sooner rather than later, I actually think that's potentially going to be a benefit official to them in terms of their likelihood to be retained and to persist to the next semester.
Ms. Flores.
Thank you, Chair Fattay. Thank you, Wendy. I also just wanted to mention, as far as the concern about the negative impact on students, if students fall into that state grant eligibility range and they're also falling into the North Star Promise range, there at least would be some protection up to tuition and fees for that student who would miss the state grant deadline. So that's one comment I just wanted to make. So definitely for those students who are falling under that 80,000 median income and the rest of the North Star Promise eligibility criteria. The other piece I was going to point out is the benefit of having the 30th day of the term versus a set date definitely makes it a little bit more student friendly, and that it's unique to that student for the institution they're attending. We do have some institutions that start, you know, as early as, you know, August 20th, 23rd, somewhere in that range, and others that start, you know, further into that second week of September. So allowing it that 30th day of the term is really student focused or specific versus institution or system specific. So I just kind of wanted to throw that into the conversation.
Representative Coulter.
I promise this is the last thing I'm going to say about this. I just also wanted to clarify that I'm certainly not opposed to an application deadline. I think the conversation about when that deadline is really what the key is here. So now I'm done. I promise.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Are there any other questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Robinson and Ms. Flores. That will conclude our walkthrough of the state grants statutory parameters. Are there any final questions or comments before we adjourn? Seeing none, we are now adjourned.